You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And today my guest is the author of a new book that captures the major changes in our economy through the lens of a major American company familiar to us all. That company is Amazon, and this topic and book is very timely in our listening area due to the recent news that Amazon will be locating a new fulfillment center right here in the Quad Cities across the river in Davenport. The book is called Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America, and the author is Alec McGillis. I'm very happy he's joining us today. Alec, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me, Robin.
Really great book. It fits into one of the core themes of this show since I've been on over the past 7 years, of looking at changes in the economy and how it's impacted our region. You've got a prolific career in journalism, and you're now a senior reporter for ProPublica, which for our listeners that don't know is an investigative journalism outlet that is nonprofit and independent. But what led you to kind of focus on this topic in particular?
It really goes back quite a lot of years, and actually started out being not a book about Amazon at all. I became more and more concerned as I was traveling the country as a national political reporter for the Washington Post, going back to 2008, 2009. The Obama campaign, the Great Recession, going back to those years, growing more and more concerned about regional inequality, like the growing gaps between cities, these just incredible disparities that you see between a small handful of sort of winner-take-all cities, mostly on the coast, and then a whole bunch of smaller, left-behind cities and towns across the country, cities very much like the Quad Cities that have really been left behind by our modern economy. And that incredible disparity is something that I believe lies at the heart of a lot of the sort of ugliness in our politics, the distortions in our politics that we've been seeing in recent years. And I wanted to write about it. I wanted to write about it, especially after Trump got elected. And it was pretty clear that the role that disparities and the resentments that they create played in his election. And so I finally decided to frame this book about these disparities through the lens of Amazon. And I settled on Amazon as the frame for a couple reasons. One is that the company is so ubiquitous in our country now that it simply serves as a handy thread to kind of take you around the country and show you what we're becoming, because it's just everywhere. So it's kind of a good metaphorical way of kind of looking at our society. But then it's also a good way of looking at this problem of regional disparities, because it is itself contributing to the problem. It and the other tech giants are contributing to the problem, because so much of the wealth and prosperity and commerce in our country that used to be spread all around is now increasingly kind of being sucked into the parts of the country, into the cities where this handful of giants are based. So a lot of retail commerce that used to be just dispersed all around the country is now increasingly drawn to Seattle, because you have this one company that now controls more than 40% of all e-commerce at a time when e-commerce is booming. And so that's, to put it very crudely, that's what's happening at the sort of national level. You have this concentration of wealth at the regional level that is closely tied to the concentration of our economy in a handful of gigantic companies.
Let's get right into the local announcement here. The Davenport facility is planned to be a robotics fulfillment center, $250 million investment, 1,000 jobs, starting at $16 an hour. Iowa has 7 Amazon facilities either built or underway. That sounds pretty good. Is that a case of maybe Amazon trying to spread the wealth out a little bit here in the middle of the country?
Not really. What's basically happening now with Amazon is that it's gotten so big, and so many of us are buying so much stuff from them, and then they've also kind of increased their promises of delivery times, often to the point of one-day delivery, that they kind of have to be everywhere now to fulfill those promises. It used to be that they would put the warehouses very strategically in only in places that would help them from a tax standpoint. The way that e-commerce taxes have worked for many years was that e-commerce companies like Amazon did not have to assess sales taxes on customers buying stuff from them if the company had no physical presence in the state where the customer lived. So it was to Amazon's benefit to actually be relatively restrained in where it put its warehouses. And also to not put warehouses in the biggest state as much as possible, because that way you could avoid assessing sales taxes to customers in those big states. So, for instance, Ohio, they did not build a warehouse, any warehouses in Ohio until not that long ago. And this is why they put the company in Seattle to begin with. If they'd put the company in California, along with all the other tech companies, they would have had to assess sales taxes in California right off the bat. They didn't want to have to do that. But now it's got a point where they really just kind of have to be everywhere to fulfill the promise of delivery and all the stuff that we're buying from them. So you're seeing them building warehouses just about everywhere. There are now only 6 states in the entire country, I believe, that have no Amazon warehouse. So the company, of course, points to these warehouses as proof that they are providing jobs out around the country in a way that, you know, Google and Facebook are not. Amazon definitely has more of a physical, large physical employment presence around the country that those other tech giants do not. The thing to keep in mind, though, of course, well, there are a couple things to keep in mind. The main one is that these jobs that are, quote, being created are not being created in a vacuum. There's another part of this picture. The other part of the picture is that there's been this massive job loss in brick and mortar retail in recent years. The retail salesperson job has been the hardest hit of any in the country, more than the coal miner, more than the newspaper reporter. And so you have essentially these warehouse jobs replacing this other form of retail job. And in some cases, those retail jobs might have paid less or better than these Amazon jobs. That kind of varied by the job. But what we do know is that the retail jobs were definitely less physically taxing jobs, less grueling jobs, also jobs that were less isolating and more sort of somewhat connected to sort of the fabric of a place that they're in. Whereas the Amazon jobs, of course, are in these windowless warehouses out in the edge of town. So we've really ended up with just a completely different kind of job, replacing one for the other. That's something that's very important to keep in mind.
So what you're saying is kind of the context where you're comparing
exactly.
The Amazon jobs versus the old Main Street jobs that we used to have in small business that aren't around anymore, and also comparing it with the lost manufacturing jobs to a degree.
Right. That's the other important comparison that you have in a lot of these places, including an example I use in the book, this amazing story of a peninsula outside Baltimore called Sparrows Point, where you now have, it used to hold the largest steelworks in the entire world, the Bethlehem Steel Mill, that's been replaced now by several Amazon warehouses. And so you have people in the exact same piece of land, where you used to be making $35 an hour making steel for bridges and skyscrapers, now, picking and packing stuff that was made halfway around the world, making $15 an hour. And I actually found a gentleman who worked both jobs, went from working at Best Steel for 30 years, making a really good money, feeling a real sense of purpose on the job, to now working in the warehouse and feeling much less sense of purpose, much less camaraderie, and of course making much less money. So in a sense, you have a situation now where we've basically kind of replaced, you used to have several different options for kind of mass options for kind of entry level working class employment. If you didn't have a college degree or specialized training and you needed a job, you went down to the mill or you went to the factory, you went to maybe the shopping mall and got a job there. Now, we're increasingly replacing those with a warehouse. The warehouse has increasingly become the sort of new mass option. And that work, that warehouse work is both, this is kind of a new kind of no man's land where it's both more physically taxing and isolating than the retail work used to be, the job of the retail salesperson. It more resembles the job of an assembly line worker, but it's less well paid than the job of the assembly line worker. So it's kind of in this new middle ground that is lacking in several ways.
Your book documents some of the issues involved with worker safety and lapses in Amazon. Also, the recent book and movie Nomadland did that as well to some degree. However, on the other hand, in fairness, there was a big vote to unionize down in Alabama, and it was rejected pretty overwhelmingly. Has it reached? Maybe it hasn't reached that level where it would be the major impetus to bring in some type of union representation, or have the conditions maybe in the warehouses improve some? Are you aware of that, or what's your reaction to that?
My reaction to that is that I was not that surprised that the vote went the way it did. It's very tough these days to organize large private sector companies. The laws in our country have been very slanted against organizing for decades now, basically ever since the Taft-Hartley Act passed in the early post-war years, with the law passed in reaction to a lot of the successful organizing in the 30s and 40s. And ever since, it's been really tough to organize workplaces. The rules of the game are just very slanted against organizers. That's the big reason why we've fallen to, gosh, like below 7% private sector unionization. And so you have all these, you know, the situation where the employer is able to hold all these captive audience meetings with workers and just really has way more access to the workers to make their case than does the organizer. But on top of that, I think there's this other problem that's facing the organizers, even at warehouses, you know, where a lot of people are upset about the conditions and about how just incredibly hard they're being driven. And that is the incredible high turnover at the warehouses and just how completely kind of atomized the work is there, where you barely know anyone that you're working with. The work is so isolating. It's really hard to form any kind of sense of solidarity when you have turnover that is often 100% in the course of a year. So basically, on average, the entire warehouse sort of being replaced in the course of a year. One organizer I spoke with said that one of their main goals is really simply to get people to stay at the warehouses longer, to work there for longer tenures, and that's almost a prerequisite before we can even start trying to actually organize them. You simply have to get them to stick around and get to know each other. And Amazon knows this, and it's why they actually encourage high turnover. But usually employers want people to stick around, you know, to get more experience and get better at their job. In the case of Amazon, they encourage high turnover. They encourage it by they often offer bonuses for people to leave. It's like an exit bonus. If you don't really want to stick around, we'd rather you just leave. So you get $1,000 to just head out. You'll get, they often offer community college courses for people, which on the one hand is, you know, a good thing, a nice benefit, but it's also something that's also meant to encourage people, to move on up and out to find something else. They are very, stingy with promotions compared to even to a Walmart. They're much less likely to promote people from the warehouse floor up to other sort of supervisory jobs within the warehouse. So it's all with an eye toward sort of limiting the kind of fellowship that might produce solidarity and organization. So that's all. And that's none of that to say that it's a lost cause. I think that the fight's going to go on with the organizing. You have to keep in mind that industries like steel took decades before they finally did get organized.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author Alec McGillis, whose recent book is called Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. We've been talking a little bit about the book here. It's focused on talking about changes in the economy, spreading economic inequality, regional inequality through the lens of this one company, Amazon. I read one comment you made, and it struck me as so true. I remember the promises of the Internet early on, that this was supposed to disperse economic opportunity throughout the country, where you could live and work anywhere. It hasn't turned out. You touched on a little of this before, but I'd like you to describe that a little bit. It also plays into this educational attainment inequality, it seems, where the jobs go where more people have higher degrees of education. Is that correct?
That's right. There's something about the tech economy that is, in the fancy word of the economist, is very agglomerating. Basically, you know, it's a winner-take-all situation, a rich-get-richer situation, where it's different than what you used to have in the manufacturing era, where once you had a given manufacturing advance and manufacturing innovation, like say the Bessemer steelmaking process that created the modern steel mill, you could build a steel mill anywhere where you had enough natural resources and basic manpower and transportation to get your product to market. In the case of the tech economy, it's different. There, the whole value lies in the initial innovation, you know, in that software that you've created, that app you've created, and the sort of manufacturing that's going to flow from that is almost kind of immaterial. That's the value lies in that first innovation. So it's all about getting all that sort of, you know, human capital, as they call it, you know, that the great minds together in one place in proximity to produce the innovations. It's just the way that we've always produced innovations in urban settings, you know, throughout time, right? Back to Renaissance Florence or industrial age Glasgow. It's just very clear that breakthroughs happen when you have people together in proximity, and also, of course, in proximity with venture capital to sort of pitch things to at the cocktail party or in the elevator to get your funding. And so you end up, that's how you end up with a Silicon Valley. That's how you end up with a Seattle. Another reason why Jeff Bezos picked Seattle to start Amazon is not just the tax, advantage that I described earlier, but also the fact that Microsoft is already there. So, you know, you're going to be able to sort of, draw talent from Microsoft as you're building up Amazon. And then more and more companies then follow and come there because they also want to draw on that talent. And then from the employee standpoint, you want to be in that place as well, because there are a bunch of different companies that you can go work for. If the one doesn't work out, you can go to the other one across the street. On top of that, I think there's also some sociological aspects to this, one of which is that now that you have increasingly dual earning professional couples, you have a situation where you want to be in a place where both of you can hope to find good, high paid, fulfilling jobs. So back in the day, if dad saw an intriguing job in St. Louis or Buffalo or Davenport, he might say, "Hey, let's go do this. This seems great for me." Now the other spouse, whether it's mom or dad or whoever it might be, is going to say, "Well, what about me?" It makes much more sense for you to be in the big coastal city where there's just tons of opportunities for both of you. And finally, you do have also a tendency now increasingly among the educated, highly educated sort of upper middle class, the census data shows this, an increased tendency to live amongst each other, a preference for clustering amongst each other. Upper middle class people used to be much more likely to live among middle class neighborhoods than they are now. Now they're much more likely to cluster with each other. It's almost like they're seeking kind of comfort and safety in their own kind. So all those different factors lead you to have this kind of this clustering effect that is not what we were promised in the internet age, where we were supposed to be able to be anywhere. And there's of course been some hope that with the pandemic, that one of the silver linings of this terrible pandemic was that it showed that remote work does work, and that we could in fact now scatter to wherever we wanted to be. There's been a little bit of that, but most of the evidence I've seen suggests that those moves, to the extent that they're happening, people leaving San Francisco, leaving New York, they're moving to other winter cities that are slightly more affordable, like in Austin. They're moving to sort of resort kind of places, to the mountains or to beach towns, or they're moving just to the suburb within their own region, to fancy suburbs within their region. They're very unlikely to be moving to the hard hit left behind cities where they could find such great affordable housing and you know, I would argue live a more expansive life. That move is unfortunately not seeming to happen very much.
You do a great job of going through that whole process, and I remember like it was yesterday of the second headquarters for Amazon, and I remember that because when you looked at some of the qualifying standards and criteria they had, it was just almost depressing that areas like ours were not going to be able to reach those. And a lot of cities around here, I know, and counties went ahead and submitted applications anyway, kind of knowing that it was going to be fruitless. But you take us through that process, and in the context of what I thought, the entire book's great. I highly recommend our listeners get a copy. But the crisis of small town America, and it plays right into that, where the lack of hope and the feeling of helplessness and inadequacy that we kind of all felt when they came out with these criteria And it was like a bidding war among all these places. But talk a little bit about that as well, that process and how it's played out.
Oh, it turns out to have been just kind of a ruse, the whole thing. I mean, all these cities made their bids, spent all this time and money putting these bids together. 238 or so bids in the end that came in. And then it was clear already when they announced their 20 finalists for it that they had no interest in using this selection of a second headquarters with this massive investment of jobs and money, using it as some way to kind of lift up a place that could really use a boost, that virtually all of the cities in that finalists, 20 finalists list were what I would consider winner cities. Even the ones that were sort of in the interior of the country were cities that are really kind of regional winner-take-all cities that have become kind of the giants in their region, kind of drawing, kind of soaking up a lot of the growth and prosperity in their part of the country, such as Columbus, Ohio, or Nashville. And then you get down to the actual choice of the winners, and they pick the two cities, two most obvious cities all along, the two big winner cities on the East Coast, New York and DC, the capital of finance, the capital of government, and the New York option kind of blows up in a fit of resistance from progressive resistors in New York. And so now they're left with Washington. So you have the company choosing for its second headquarters, the city that is already the wealthiest metro area in the entire country with 5 or 6 of the 10 wealthiest counties in the country, a city that's already just incredibly expensive, incredibly crowded, incredibly congested. That's where they're going to go with these 25,000 jobs. And the reason they're doing that, of course, is that, again, you have the tech talent there. You have all these sort of tech workers that are already working in the Beltway for all the different contractors and all that. But the other reason they're going there, of course, the less sort of publicly stated reason, is that Washington is the seat of the federal government. And they know that their biggest threat right now is not from another company, but the threat of possible federal intervention. So it makes sense for them to build up their presence in Washington, to be the sort of big friendly presence, you know, not the scary company out west, but just a nice big local employer who employs the guy who lives next to you and employs the mom that you see at the soccer game. And so that was absolutely a big reason for their choosing Washington. But for all these other cities that spent all this time making their bids, it just turned out to have been kind of a joke.
You talk about Amazon's growing role in politics. It started out with very little political footprint, and you document, which we won't have time to talk about today, their involvement in the Seattle proposed head tax, which is really interesting. But I really like your reporting on, or reporting within the book, on the kind of dilemma that the Democrats are in. This is the party traditionally most associated with the tech industry, yet a lot of the former high-ranking Obama officials have gone to work for tech companies. What's the prospects now with Democrats in control? They're looking at antitrust measures, toughening antitrust to try to address some of the some of the problems facing Main Street America. But yet there's a lot of Democrats here involved with this. What's the chances for any substantive action here, do you think?
It's a really intriguing dynamic, and you really put your finger on it. There's this fascinating rift now within the left, within Democrats, where you have, on the one hand, a real sort of affinity between elite Democrats in Silicon Valley, you know, all the people from the Obama administration who went to work for the tech giants, such as Jay Carney, the former Obama White House spokesman, who's now the chief PR guy for Amazon, many, many others as well. And a lot of Silicon Valley money, campaign money has gone to the Democrats over the years. So you have that kind of elite political affinity. You also have a real strong affinity between a lot of rank and file Democratic consumers and the company. The company is, you know, universal in its sales and its appeal, of course, but it has its strongest demographic really is, you know, upper middle class Democrats in big blue metros who buy a lot of stuff from Amazon and bought even more this past year during the pandemic, when you essentially had Democrats, of course, being much more COVID cautious than Republicans, which meant that the reliance on Amazon, the reliance on the kind of one-click life was especially strong in blue places. So you have this strong consumer affinity for Amazon on the left as well. But then you have now a lot of people within the party who are growing increasingly critical of the company and the other tech giants and increasingly worried about a new age of monopoly. People like Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and Lina Khan, who's this young woman who just a few years ago as a law student wrote this groundbreaking article making the case for why Amazon is in fact a harmful monopoly and has now been named to be chair of the Federal Trade Commission at age 32. It's really quite remarkable. And so you have this this real kind of internal struggle within the Democratic Party over what to do with these companies. And you have bills that are passed that are coming through the House right now. Five bills meant to attack these new monopolies or quasi monopolies. But one thing you've seen is that, for instance, some of the votes they were not able to get on those bills were some quite powerful California Democrats who are very protective of their tech giants. And so it's going to be fascinating to watch this play out. And then on the right, you have an equivalent kind of interesting struggle going on between kind of more traditional business-friendly Republicans who still more or less see the tech giants as exemplars of American business success and business greatness. But then some Republicans who now are also worried about monopoly and also are also aggrieved by what they see as discrimination by the social media companies against President Trump and other conservatives. And so you've got, it's a very interesting issue now because there's rifts in both sides. It kind of cuts across party lines in a way that a lot of issues these days don't.
It's going to be very interesting, fascinating to follow. As you say, there's kind of this more populist versus more, perhaps more of an elitist push and pull in both parties. That'll be interesting to see how it turns out. Alec, we're out of time, but folks, we've barely touched the surface of this book. It's really outstanding. A lot of important implications and findings here. It's called Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. The author is Alec McGillis. He's been our guest today. And Alec, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.